Jim Gortney, currently a professor of economics at Florida State University in Tallahassee. He's an old friend of mine who fits into what some think is the oxymoronic category of Christian economists. The only place where we might differ is that I take a more dangerous position that there might be something called Christian economics, which Jim would be firmly opposed to, I believe. Jim has written numerous books, including the Best Principles textbook, but I can plug in for that for any potential principles teachers out there. Best Principles textbook in the business, co-authored by Richard Stroup. He has also written, published, and lectured extensively on the subject of poverty and empirical effects, and we will hear him this morning. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill. I face a real crisis myself in terms of how to deal with the current situation. You know, being a professor, that means that I think at 50-minute intervals, and our time is going to be less than that today, and I have a double disadvantage, as Bill alluded to, as being a textbook author, and readers of textbooks, and particularly introductory economics textbooks, will tell you they can't sell anything in less than 850 pages. So that's a real problem. You know, we taught politicians, learned how to communicate in 20-second bits, so I might try to duplicate them a little bit. The only problem is that they also took up the habit of thinking in 20-second bits. And that's proved to be a real problem. Well, in light of the difficulty of saying what I'd like to say in less than 50 minutes, I'd like to begin by really indicating the three points that I'd like to get across to you and then spend some time on each of those three, although probably more on one of them than the other two. The three points that I would like to communicate to you is the importance of focusing the debate on the welfare state on the issue of the effectiveness of the transfer programs rather than the intentions of the transfer programs. Secondly, I'd like to explain why the current transfer programs have failed. And thirdly, I'd like to explain what may seem paradoxical to some of you, and that is why that it's extremely difficult to help intended beneficiaries by giving them transfers. It's difficult to do it, even if that is, in fact, your intention. First of all, the issue of the intentions. For years, the welfare state proponents have framed the issue. The debate has focused on, should the government use its transfer powers to help the poor? And, of course, the compassionate response to that issue is yes. And therefore, the logical conclusion is, if, in fact, your answer to that is no, then you lack compassion. And the very framing of that issue, I would argue, puts us at a very serious disadvantage, and one in which the debate, almost the cards are stacked against us before we start, and it's almost sure that we will lose. I would argue that the relevant way to frame the debate, or to present the relevant issue, is will the economic status of the poor be improved if the transfer sector of the government is enlarged? Both economic theory and the empirical evidence, I would suggest, indicate that the answer to that question is no, that the transfer sector has, in fact, done very little to improve the economic status of the poor, and for that matter, if we want to expand it to a broader sector of analysis for many other or most other intended beneficiaries. Why have transfer programs failed to help the poor? Now, some of you might question whether or not that has been the case, perhaps not in this particular audience, but if you look at the empirical evidence, that certainly in the 20 years following World War II, there was a steady decline in the rate of percentage of people who were in poverty. It was across all age groupings and across all demographic groupings. But just about the time, or shortly after the time, that we initiated a large increase in transfer expenditures, particularly during the 1965-75 period, a funny thing happened to that declining trend and progress that we were making against poverty. And that is, except for the elderly, it began to reverse itself. Now, one can argue how strongly it reversed itself, or maybe it only bottomed out, or something of that sort. And there is, of course, some debate on that issue related to how you calculate the poverty rate and the inclusion of in-kind benefits and that sort of thing. But the bottom line on that debate is there's certainly been a clear decline in the rate of progress that was made against poverty that took place at about the time the transfer programs were expanded. Now, why have transfer programs? Why is there reason to question whether or not enlargement of the transfer sector will help the poor? I think there's four major reasons for that, and the first of those is really political. And that is that there's very little reason to expect, if you open up the transfer windows, that the poor are in fact going to be the major beneficiaries of politicizing the income distribution. The poor, for example, what comes out of public choice theory is the kinds of programs that tend to be attractive to political entrepreneurs, politicians, are those programs that spread the cost evenly across a large number of people and make it difficult for them to identify that that cost is being imposed on them, and keep the cost individually small on this disorganized group in order to provide concentrated benefits to well-organized groups. That's essentially what the modern political process has become all about. And that when you ask yourself, therefore, is there reason to expect that the poor are going to be the major beneficiaries of these kinds of programs? I think that the answer is clearly no, that they're not well organized. They vote less than persons in higher, at a lower rate than people in higher income brackets. They're not a major source of campaign funds. So the bottom line is that the politicians are not going to find transfers to the poor particularly attractive. And of course, as we look at the kinds of transfers that are observed in the real world, the evidence is consistent with that, that roughly one out of every six transfer dollars is in fact means tested. And if you included the regulatory elements, it would be even less than that. So most transfers are from the disorganized groups to well-organized concentrated groups, rather than egalitarian type of transfers or transfers targeted toward the poor. Now, a second reason why the transfer programs have expansion of the size of the transfer sector is not going to do much to help the poor is that the programs, let me introduce this topic by dealing with the second issue that I talked about, and that is why it's difficult to help people that by giving them transfers. The problem here is that you in a world of scarce resources, you have to have some means of rationing transfers. If you don't ration them, they're clearly going to overrun the size of the budget. The number of people who are willing to accept $50 bills if you're willing to mail them out to them is very large. So it will exhaust the total amount of resources. So you have to have some kind of a rationing mechanism set up to decide who's going to get a finite available transfers. Now, by the rationing mechanism that you set up, you tend to reduce the value of the transfers to the beneficiaries. That you make it less likely that the transfer will, in fact, do much to improve their well-being. In fact, there are three major methods that we utilize to ration transfers. Three major methods are that you require people to own something, or that you require people to do something, or you require people to be something. It's basically the methods that we utilize to ration transfers. Now think of the side effects of each one of those rationing devices. If you require people to own something in order to get a flow of transfer income, what happens is the flow of transfer income gets capitalized into the value of the thing that you have to own in order to get the transfers, so people bid up the price for it and in effect pay for the transfer right. The clearest example of this is the agriculture program, where you have to own land with acreage allotments in order to get the benefit of the higher price support programs. The value of that transfer then becomes capitalized into the value of land with acreage allotments, and people bid up the price of land with acreage allotments. And the program does absolutely nothing to improve the economic welfare of the new entrants into the program. The beneficiaries of the program are people who own land with acreage allotments at the time the program was institutionalized and at the time that it was unexpectedly increased. By and large, they're dead and gone. The current farmers are in no way helped by the program because they have to pay for the thing that's necessary in order to get the transfer. Is it any wonder that the program does nothing to save the family farm? The second kind of rationing mechanism to require people to do something, okay, means that in order to get the transfer, you have to perform certain kind of function. That, therefore, how will people decide whether or not to do it? The answer is whether or not the cost incurred by doing the thing that's necessary to get the transfer is equal or less than the value of the transfer. And people will compete for the transfer, that is to say, incur costs doing the things necessary to get to the transfer, right up to the expected value of what it is that they have to do is exactly equal to the transfer. The clearest example of this, in order to illustrate the point I like to use in my classrooms, is that is waiting in line. Suppose, in fact, the Treasury was giving away $50 bills at 15th and Pennsylvania Avenue. A line would form, and how would you decide whether or not to get in the line? The answer is you would figure what your opportunity cost of waiting in line was, and if your opportunity cost of waiting in line was $49.99, you'd get in line, and you'd receive a net transfer of 1 cent at a cost to the taxpayer and the government of $50. Now, because you essentially, by requiring you to do something, and see, it's necessary that you have some have a rationing device, so it's not that they're just sort of decided to waste the resources here, but requiring you to do something that you, by and large, erode the value of the transfer. We have the programs of this type would be things like small SBA's below-market interest rate loan, various kinds of licensing programs that are based on supply restrictions and make it difficult to get her into the occupation. People incur costs meeting the waiting in line, meeting the criteria right up to where they completely exhaust the value of the transfer. Now, the third method of rationing is to require people to do something. Be something. And by and large, this is the method that's perhaps most relevant to the issue of the poor. What we require the poor to be is we require that they be poor and promise to stay poor. And then, in fact, we will help them. That they receive the transfer, that they become poor. The most significant side effect is that it means that individuals, because if you move into the non-poor class, that is to say that if your income increases, then you don't qualify, that individuals have relatively little incentive to help themselves, that they confront very high marginal tax rates, and in the process of confronting those high marginal tax rates, that they have an incentive to opt out of the labor force. Now, think of the side effects of those in terms of that rationing mechanism, in terms of the value of the transfer to the poor. That because they face very high marginal tax rates, that they earn less than otherwise would be the case, so a good deal of the income ends up being merely replacement income that they would have earned had the transfer program not been in place. And secondly, it gives them an incentive to opt out of the workforce. And as they opt out of the workforce, what happens to the quality of their skills? Their skills deteriorate, and they become less able to support themselves off out into the future. So individuals, as they evaluate this particular rationing mechanism, it reduces their incentive to help themselves and to become self-sufficient individuals. And a great deal of the value of the transfer to the poor is eroded in this particular process. Now, another element of side effects of the transfers that explain why they have failed is that the transfers tend to crowd out private charity. In fact, I think this is one of the most destructive elements of the current transfer system, that they tend to leave individuals who come in contact with poor people and various kinds of church organizations and other kinds of community organizations with the idea, well, I already am contributing through my tax dollar, so I'll tell you where the food stamp office is, rather than in any way get involved in the problems of low-income status and that of individuals that we come in contact with. So that there's less private voluntary giving to deal with this issue. And the reason why that's so important is because private voluntary means can be tailor-made to what the nature of the problem is. They make the sacrifice of the donor much clearer to the recipient, and therefore you get a much greater effectiveness in voluntary transfers than you would for public sector transfers. So, as the result of all this, the transfer programs tend to do much less to help the poor than what is generally perceived. And that with the passage of time, I would argue that there's reason to think that there's really no trade-off at all between expanding the size of transfers and reducing the number of people who are experiencing poverty. That this case reminds me a little bit of one having to do with the debate about macroeconomics in the 1960s, the famous Phillips curve trade-off. The trade-off between inflation and unemployment. And Milton Friedman at that time was very fond of saying that, you know, there isn't any trade-off between inflation and unemployment. The trade-off is between a lower unemployment rate today and a higher unemployment rate in the future. And that's exactly the case with transfer programs. To the extent there's any trade-off related to the size of the transfer sector, the trade-off is one of between, if we unexpectedly increase the transfer sector, there may be a slightly lower short-run incidence of poverty, but at the cost of a higher future rate of poverty. And while Keynes, of course, used to tell us that in the long run we're all dead, we know that's not true, that what really he meant to say is in the long run he would be dead, and that the rest of us would be here to experience the insanity of the policies that he followed. Well, where does all this lead us then? And if I had 50 minutes, I would deal with the last section of my paper, but since I don't have 50 minutes to, I would just like to summarize what I think the major implications are as far as the solution to the dilemma that we face. I think it's crucial that we reform the transfer sector if we cannot abolish it, and the kinds of reforms that would be that would be helpful would be moving in the direction of sharply reducing that marginal tax rate, so that low-income people would have greater incentive to help themselves. Immediate discontinuation of paying people not to work. Paying people not to work was an absolutely bad idea because you get more people then who end up not producing, and we're all worse off as a result of that. And as Alan Carlson referred to, that we certainly need to discontinue all types of transfer programs that are favorable to single-parent families relative to multi-parent families. And finally, that we need to recognize that there are cases that are beyond the reach of the state, and that it would be they would be best left for the voluntary sector. Thank you.